The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much for these nice words. Always entertaining to hear the introductions. I was looking for some new facts from my biography. It's amazing, you know, how the legend grows and, you know, you find new facts and you feel uncomfortable to confront people because this time it was fine, yes. Short and fine, no complaints. It's always nice to be here in Philadelphia. Just arriving here on train, I just recognize that that's the city I played only once, but what a match. Here I played Deep Blue in 1996. And this is the... And this is the territory where IBM tricks are not working. Now, while I'm being introduced those days, so people mixing, of course, chess... chess champion, the highest-rated player, and then the author of the book, and, of course, my new political endeavors and challenges that I'm trying to pose for President Putin and his regime in Russia. And they're praising my courage and the courage of my colleagues in Russia who are taking this chance, confronting Putin's regime, which looks increasingly dictatorial. Yeah, they say it takes courage to run for president in Russia, but when I look at the list of candidates in the United States, it seems to me it takes even more courage in your country not to run. Now, about the book. First question I'm always asking, Gary, Mr. Kasparov, the title of the book is How Life Imitates Chess. Just a couple of words about the title. It was a working title when I started thinking about the project in November 2003. It was still chess age for me. I've been playing chess, and I thought about sharing my experience with the rest of the world about decision-making. Probably I already recognize that soon when the book would be ready, I'll be out of the game of chess. It didn't happen often when the working title was eventually accepted by the publishers almost all over the world. So people like the title, but they always ask me what did it mean. So how life imitates chess? Do you believe that life imitates chess? And does the knowledge of the game of chess help you to do anything else? Now, my response is, no, the talent of playing chess is good for playing chess. And that's not about imitation. It's about personal experience. So the book is about my ambitious attempt to analyze the nature of decision-making. There are many books written about it. There are many lectures. There are motivational speakers. And obviously, I have entered the world with a lot of competitors. Everybody is trying to come up with universal solution for everybody. And it reminded me of my early days in chess. When I was a kid, I was better than others. And other kids in the neighborhood asked me about a tip. Gary, could you give us a tip to beat another neighbor? Then I grew up and I heard this question time and again. Could you share with us some intimate knowledge, some tip? People always wanted to know something simple, universal, working in all cases. After being confronted with this question for almost 35 years, I came to the conclusion that the only tip I can give you is that there are no tips. Because tips are counterproductive. Tips mean that there is one universal solution, but it may not work for you while it could work for someone else. Instead of trying to find this generic recipe or generic advice, which is promoted by different business gurus or motivational speakers, we have to look inward. And this book is it's about self-awareness. It's an attempt to share my experience as a decision maker, what and how I learned about my successes and about my failures. And I urge my readers to do the same. Chess is merely a tool, the tool to help you to analyze your own strengths and your own weaknesses. Because we are not tend to be open with ourselves. Sometimes we don't like what we discover. But that's a first step on the way to success or on the way to failure. Because in my view, I'm convinced that decision-making is as unique as fingerprints or DNA. We're all different. And something that works for me may not work for you because we look at same things from different angles. There's nothing wrong about it. And sometimes people are ashamed about their own preferences. They want to be more dynamic, more aggressive, or, you know, be more conservative. Depends on the role model they pick up to follow. Again, there's nothing wrong about it. So it's about your own strengths, about your own weaknesses, and about your own comfort. Because making decisions, it always involves your different components of your character. And you might be very dynamic. Fine. So you should look for the decisions that could feature this quality. And there is nothing wrong about being on one or another side of the of this equation. You can look at the tennis player, aggressive tennis player with a very powerful serve who rushes to the net. And you could look at the tennis player who prefers to play from the back line. They both could be number one. So what's wrong about it? If you look at soccer, you had a Brazilian team known for its aggressiveness and dynamism. They won world title 5 times. Italians, known for catenaccio, the defensive style, won it 4 times. I was known for an aggressive style. Karpov was more of a defensive player. We both were world champions. First and utmost is to understand everything about you. So self-awareness, how we analyze our own performance. And then, you know, analyzing our own performance, it's not as simple, because we all know that if we lost, if we failed, we have to go back and to look for the mistake because we did something wrong. But if we won, it's because we're great. It's a human complacency. Why should we look backward if we won? Now, my experience as a professional player who had been playing chess for quite a long time, and I have to tell you that, you know, while I won hundreds of games, I also lost dozens of games. There's nothing wrong about it. So it's, I always say that when you start playing, you have to understand that there are different outcomes, potential outcomes. And one of the important things is to have courage to fail, because you can fail. And if you're afraid of the failure, so you are already on the losing track. But now, let's say we won. And from my experience, I know that it may not be a result of our great play, of our great performance. Most likely, it's because our opponents made the last mistake. But all the great games, even the greatest games, they're full, maybe not with many mistakes, but there are always mistakes or inaccuracies. It's like, you know, an exchange of mistakes. Some say it's a comedy of mistakes. But even the greatest players, they know that in the games they won, something could be found wrong on their side. From mathematics, we understand that there are always more losers than winners. It means that the losers are analyzing these games and trying to find out what we did wrong while we were on the winning side. The reason I stayed on top for 20 years, because I was relentless analyzing my own games, the games I won. I knew there would be mistakes there, and I was always trying to discover these mistakes before my opponents did. And to surprise them every time we met again at new encounter with new strategies, new ideas. You have to be absolutely open with yourself. You have to be very self-critical and not to be ashamed. At the end of the day, so we all humans, we make mistakes. What is important, it's our ability to look at this mistake, to find the mistakes, and even to confess. So even if you recognize them publicly, it's probably, in my view, just constitutes more strengths than weaknesses. So we know that there is no universal formula for success, and it's up to us so to identify what is good for us, so how we should act. But we do not act in a vacuum. We have an opponent. We have an opposition in business, in politics, in, God forbid, on the military battlefield. Even, you know, in a daily life, we have to make choices that could be conflicting choices. So what should we do? So I argue that we have to look at the big picture. We have to analyze different factors. That's in the book I call it MTQ, material, time, and quality. And I argue that people do it all the time, subconsciously. Because any decision we make, it involves material factor, time factor, and a quality factor. In chess, I could explain it in graphic terms. Because, you know, you have material to be sacrificed for to gain some time, and then numerous quality factors that could compensate you for material or time loss. So we're always exchanging. So we're looking for potential investment, and then we should contemplate whether we're losing some time or we're gaining some time. And again, quality factors are totally numerous. So if we're looking for school for our kids, we always look at the price for the tuition, distance to the school, future possibilities. And again, it could be measured by, you know, financial abilities of the family now to spend this kind of money for X amount of years, or you should do something else. So every decision we make, you know, involves these three factors of these three categories, material, time, and quality. And we have to be absolutely objective by analyzing it. Because if we do not have enough resources, we have to make sure that our policy fits, you know, our current abilities. So in Russia today, the opposition is too weak to attack. So we have to be satisfied. We have to recognize that the best strategy for us is tactics of survival. Every day we survive, we reach out more people. Every day we survive, we expand the territory our coalition, the other Russia, controls. And every day we survive makes life for the regime a bit more annoying because we're there. We're there as an alternative. And there's nothing wrong about it. So if you are on the weak side, if you are facing imminent threats to your king in the game of chess, you don't have luxury thinking about sophisticated pawn structure for the end game. So you have to react now. And being reactive, if you don't have enough resources, is not wrong. There's nothing wrong about it. What is wrong is trying to be proactive when your resources are definitely insufficient. Then you also try to find out everything you can find out about the opposition. Because your opponent also have strengths and weaknesses. And when two great teams are facing each other, or were two great chess players facing each other, the decisive, most important factor, almost decisive factor, is ability to force your opponent to play your game. Because you could do a lot of things on an equal level, but you are more comfortable in some players, more comfortable in the complicated games, some are more comfortable in the quiet games. So how you move your, or drag your opponent into the territory that you know better, you feel better. It's like on the battlefield. If you have cavalry, you want to fight on a valley, if you're looking for a valley. If you are fighting against cavalry, you're looking for the hills. It's natural. In life, in chess, in business, in any other sport, in politics, you're always looking for a landscape that will be convenient, comfortable for you, for your decision-making formula, for your character, for your style, and as uncomfortable as possible for the opposition. The problem is that the opposition is looking for the same. This psychological battle, again, for me in chess it was the most important. And the reason I was able to beat Karpov in our endless matches, that every time we had the decisive game, we faced the climax, I was able to move him a little bit onto the territory that I knew better. Problem is that in the year 2000, I lost the world championship match to my former pupil, Vladimir Kramnik, who did the same to me. I had to recognize that I was well prepared for the match, but I underestimated the importance of the psychology, and he learned from me. So that was a great success, but it was also a great lesson for me. I was 37, he was 25, and I knew that for me to stay on top, and actually I stayed on top as the highest rated player for another 5 years, was to go back to the school and learn from the next generation. There was nothing wrong about it. So I had to close the gap. Not that I wanted to play the game of chess that he wanted me to play, but I learned how to actually move him from the territory he knew better onto my territory, and it helped me to stay on top. So learning, it's one of the greatest qualities, and it's never late. Also, people I think very often are mistaken by the scale of the decision. So we think that if decision is made in the White House, it's or somewhere else nearby, it's of special importance, and the structure of the decision making cannot be even compared to the decision made at the kitchen table. I believe that often decisions at the kitchen table are more accurate and intelligent. Because we're dealing with the same ingredients. We go through the same process. The scale is an illusion. It doesn't matter whether you deal with, you know, the price of the food in the local stock market or with the price of oil. At the end of the day, you add these factors and you have to make the decision based on the same way to evaluate the events, to calculate the moves. And again, it depends on the ability of a player, of an ordinary person, to accumulate these facts and to create the best solution for the current problem. Again, I will probably say a few words about my own experience. It is important to work hard. Sounds ridiculous. It's so trivial. Yes, and I was always amazed to read that in some description, in some stories, in the books, in the newspaper articles, we could see statements like he compensated the lack of talent with hard work. The reason I was amazed, because I believe working hard is also a talent. You know, some people are not capable of working hard. They're lacking this talent. And some people are maybe less talented, you know, by doing something, but they add hard work, which is also a great ability. We know people different, and some can work really hard, some cannot. Which, for me, that constitutes the lack of talent or your ability to display this quality. Again, it's clearly a talent. I was able, again, I learned it from my early days, to mix these two things. Yes, I knew I had a chess talent, but I also learned how to utilize my talent to work hard. And mixing these two things helped me to create my own winning formula. You don't have to applaud, so that's a working hard. Yeah. Changing the subject and just going into my current engagements, political engagements, I always have to mention the question I'm always asked about, this transition. Mr. Kasparov, It was still number one in March 2005. So why did you make this decision? And are you sorry about it? What are your plans? And how do you feel of being one of many after being one and the only? I knew it would be very different. But for me, playing chess was not always about winning or losing. Also, it was an important factor. But it was not the only thing. I always wanted to make the difference. The difference meant that I worked hard, I looked for new ideas, and not just beating my opponents, but pushing the game of chess step, hopefully two steps further. I did more than I could have dreamed of. I expanded the understanding of the game of chess, again, way beyond my expectations. But at a certain point, I had to think about my future because I wanted to make the difference somewhere else. I wanted to utilize my qualities and my experience. I learned a lot from the game of chess, and I believed I could share it with other people. And thinking about this new engagement, as I already mentioned, in November 2003, where I first contemplated the idea of writing this book, I thought about other things, and I couldn't ignore what was happening in my country, in Russia. Not that I was a big fan of changes in the 90s, because I thought these changes were falling short of our expectations. I was not a great admirer of Russian democracy under President Yeltsin. The democratic institutions were weak. They were flawed. But they could serve as a future foundation. And these institutions have been destroyed, demolished by President Putin over the last 7 years. And considering my future involvement, I thought that being part of the movement in Russia that is fighting against policies of Putin's administration might be the best thing I could do. Not that I was paranoid about my own importance. I knew that difference I made in the world of chess could be hardly reproduced in my own country. But encouraging other people, I thought it would be a very it would be one of the best investments of my own fame in Russia, my name recognition, and my strategic abilities to help people to look for the future and identify the options that we have or we have not. And this transition took place in March 2005. Now it's two and a half years, and people ask me often, so what did you accomplish? Things are getting worse in Russia. Yeah, I agree. Things are getting worse every day. But again, I was not overestimating my own importance and ability to reverse these things. What I thought we did, and that was an important accomplishment, we changed the framework used by Russian opposition. So recognizing that we are facing the authoritarian regime that is looking increasingly dictatorial with intentions to destroy even the remaining elements of democracy in Russia, we needed to have a very broad coalition. And I looked at the modern history and recognized there were two examples we had to try to recreate in Russia. And again, I'm not trying to use these parallels to copy something from the past, because I understand that every parallel in time and in a political space could be too loose. But still, I believe that what we're doing now is similar to what was done in Chile at the end of the 80s, when different groups, 18 groups from Christian Democrats on one side and socialists and later communists on the opposite side got together to fight Pinochet at the referendum. It was about restoring democracy in Chile. They won. And now, since that time, they're doing their own things, but they knew that without getting together, they couldn't have won. Another example by the way, recently mentioned by Václav Havel, who was in Moscow, was Charter 77. At the end of 70s, the different groups of the Czechoslovakian society, from far left to conservatives and even monarchists, got together, signed a document about restoration of democracy in Czechoslovakia. And again, they worked for democracy, they worked for freedom, recognizing that they may disagree on virtually everything else. So we succeeded in creating something similar in Russia, what we call the Other Russia Coalition. We understand that there are so many differences between us, but we agree, and thanks to Putin, no one is arguing anymore in Russia, that liberal democracy is the only foundation for the successful modern state. Free and fair elections and no censorship, those are instant conditions to guarantee that our country could be brought back to a normal democratic path. We could argue on literally everything. The problem is there is no space to argue, and we don't want this to happen in the kitchen. We want it to happen in a mass media, in the mainstream press. And we also know that if and when free and fair elections taking place in Russia, most of us will be sort of sitting in the opposite wings of the parliament. We'll be arguing, but again, it will be a different debate. It will be a very healthy political debate. And also, we believe that by getting together and unifying our forces to fight Putin's regime, we are also removing the spirit of what I called the Cold Civil War. So the civil war mentality, which still existed in Russia when opposition was considered to be an enemy. There will be different people with different views, and some of them are totally unacceptable by my standards, but they are also Russians. So what can we do? If we want to bring our country back to a civilized world, we need these different opinions to be spoken and confronted. So I think that the Other Russia was a very successful formula, and Kremlin paid enough attention by mobilizing resources to prevent us from growing and increasing our influence across the country. So we know that in Russia we are not fighting today for winning elections, we're fighting for having elections. And that's a different ball game. Also, I will finish my talk now before we start Q&A with a few more words about the book. The interesting thing about the book is that it's not only that it's published, it will be published in 27 countries. Now there are, I think, 8 or 9 editions already released, but it's that most of the books are different. It's not because it's just, they publish in different languages. But I tried to satisfy my, to complement my vision of establishing this dialogue with the reader, explaining that it's all unique. Also adding the stories that could be easily understood by the local readership. So there's a little bit of German quotes and stories in German edition, Spanish, Dutch. But the three principal editions that are different from each other, it's UK, US, and Russia. So when I tell you this story, why it did happen. The original manuscript, if anyone is interested, is UK book. So that's the book that was submitted to the publisher, and that's the, call it, official manuscript. It was rewritten a number of times, and this book contained some extra information on chess, and especially on people I learned from, because I always wanted to make the book a sort of learning manual. What I learned, how I learned, and how you could learn from my experience doing, other things. And why these people were important for me, and why I looked at this experience, and what I took from them, what I disregarded, and so on. UK version was used by most of the European publishers as as the manuscript for translation, with some corrections that, as I just described, I try to implement in other editions. U.S. edition is different because here the publisher wanted to change the concept of we to you. So it's a more straight message. So there's less chess and less biography. So it's a different approach, considering that the publisher believes that the audience needs to go straight to the point instead of getting through the way I acquired this information. The books are fundamentally the same, but if you have any interest, you could see how the publishers in different countries asked me, because it's all, it was all done by me and Mick Gringer, who worked with me on the book, and we were very comfortable of doing it. So we didn't do anything that didn't complement my vision about presenting the message. While the Russian edition, I totally reorganized it. It's just because the original was written in English. I reorganized it, went in the opposite direction. Russian edition, it's aimed at the Soviet Russian readership. It has more chess, more biography, more philosophy. And, of course, it replaces American examples and European examples by Russian examples. So if I take a case study. So I always look at something that Russian public is familiar with. And again, the books are, they're fundamentally the same, but there's quite a difference in the way the information is presented. In American edition, you have a little bit more about U.S., the presidential campaign that I analyzed, a little bit more about Deep Blue, because Man versus Machine obviously is more entertaining issue in this country than elsewhere. So that's why I felt comfortable by having these three different editions that represented my views and were adjusted to the audiences. What is interesting the publishers from different countries, they were looking at the editions and made their choices. Most of the European countries, they took the UK edition. Japan took an American edition. And Eastern European countries, they are translating from Russian edition. It's Bulgaria, I think Poland, and Baltic states, three Baltic states, which is absolutely normal because they look for the best way to entertain their readers and to present the material in the way that is easy to understand and to follow. So that's the story about the book, and I know that I still have a lot to say, but I would rather probably respond to the questions, and also it may illustrate the difference between Russian political life and American political life, because here, I can see, the politicians are getting agile in deflecting the questions. While in Russia, we are trying people to force people to ask the questions. So we are inviting them. So I'm inviting you to ask questions, and I promise I'll respond to literally everything you ask.
Folks, just so you know how this works, we've got about 15 minutes for questions. If you hold your hand up, we will get a mic to you. Please wait until the mic gets to you to talk. We'll start right here in the second row.
Thank you very much. Really appreciated the talk. I was wondering, with journalists having a high mortality rate in Russia these days, has it been difficult for you to get your message out, and has publishing your book in Russia been at all a problem?
We do not have access to mainstream press. Does it make it difficult to carry our message? Probably yes. If you have no access to the television, and the television works like Kremlin brainwashing machine, yes. But it's about comparing your position with others who tried to promote democracy in the Soviet Union. We are better off than Sakharov and Bukovsky. for instance, if we look at the 70s. We have internet. It's about 17 or 18 million people now on internet in Russia. About 10% using internet for learning about politics, which is probably normal rate in the world. And there are a few newspapers and one radio station called Echo of Moscow that is offering opportunity for all political views, from Kremlin loyalists to the radical opposition. Otherwise, we have to rely on this door-to-door campaign. As for my book in Russia, I had a contract with largest Russian publisher, also the largest book distributor in Russia. It was all signed. It was fixed. The idea was to have the book printed for the Moscow Book Fair, which is the largest book event in Moscow, in Russia, in the beginning of September this year. I delivered the manuscript, this rewritten Russian manuscript, by the end of May this year. And then suddenly in mid-August, Russian publisher informed me that they had some legal hurdles they had to resolve, and they couldn't actually have the book on time for the Moscow Book Fair. What we found out later, that the book was, of course, printed in June. But it was sitting in the store because suddenly the publisher recognized that it would be the largest book event in Russia, and the biggest book publisher will have the centerpiece of its exhibition, a Garry Kasparov book, with all the supplying events, you know, book signing, press conference. They decided to avoid even a chance of being visited by tax police next day. So that's why they postponed the release of the book. Now it's available. It's doing extremely well. So it's the number one book in this category in Russia. But at least they avoided this potential confrontation with Kremlin. I think it's a good example to show the spread of fear among even big business in Russia. You never know whether they were called by someone from Kremlin or they just decided to avoid even a potential confrontation. But as a matter of fact, so they didn't take a chance of having my book as the part of their presentation in September. But now you can buy it. Also, it's available here in America for the Russian-speaking audience. Yeah, I already signed quite a few books in my book signings in Boston and D.C. It's probably funny that it seems to me that the book was available in U.S. before it was available in Russia. Russian edition, I mean.
Another question. Over there on the left, about four rows back.
Thank you, Mr. Kasparov. You're an inspiration to many, and including me, who happens to be a native Philadelphian, but also of Armenian ancestry. Mm-hmm. As you know, dozens of parliaments throughout the world have acknowledged the Armenian genocide, including the Russian Duma. And presently, the U.S. Congress is debating whether to acknowledge this terrible tragedy, this first genocide that took place in the 20th century. As an Armenian, or at least half Armenian, who understood what happened to the Armenians in Azerbaijan, Baku, and Sumgayit, do you have any opinion as to whether a Congress like this in America should have any role in documenting history? Thank you.
I'm not sure that Russian Duma did what it had to do. So it's it was, I think, a motion which eventually died out. I'm following the campaign here. In fact, I was in D.C. on the 10th, and I was speaking at the conference organized by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, about freedom of press in Russia, or what's left of freedom of press in Russia, dedicated to Anna Politkovskaya. And the room that was used for the conference, which was opened by Congressman Tom Lantos, and I followed with my speech, and there were a bunch of interviews. When we left the room, it was filled by the Armenians that were there to actually watch the debate and the vote, because the room where it took place was not big enough, so they had to use other rooms with television screens. I think that the recognition of the tragedy that took place in 1915 would eventually take place, because Turkey is moving into the European Union, and I think it's inevitable that as a part of the recognition of Turkey as a full member of European Union, the truce about events in 1915 should be recognized. I think from my point of view, it may take a little bit more time. I would say that 2015 would be probably the date when Turkey will become a member of European Union and it will be resolved, I wouldn't say for mutual satisfaction, but to recognize the historic truths. I think Turkey understands that resolving the issue of the Northern Cyprus and Armenian genocide would be two last hurdles they will have to face before joining a European Union. As a matter of fact, I'm a great supporter of the idea of bringing Turkey into the European Union because I believe that integrating a Muslim state, a democracy, into a community of European nations is a very important step to demonstrate that the conflict today is not between Christianity and Islam, but between freedom based on the recognition of common values and the barbarians who are opposing the values that are universal for all of us. So that's why I think that this problem will be resolved. I understand the sensitivity for current Turkish government, but again, I don't think how to read the position of some U.S. Members of the House that are now defecting the coalition. What I don't want to see is a bitter partisanship as a part of fighting for the very important piece of historical truth. And the whole picture is marred by the conflict between Bush and House Democrats, because it seems to me that it's too much of this local U.S. politics interfering with something which has a universal value.
Another question? Second row right there.
Hi.
You have to move there, you know, because there's many rooms. Okay, go ahead.
Thanks very much. I was just wondering how you and the other Russia coalition would propose to combat what we're told are rising levels of xenophobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism throughout Russia.
I've been traveling intensively across Russia, and I have to tell you that, unlike in other countries, the xenophobia and anti-Semitism, those are mainly the part of the establishment. So this is the propaganda of Russian television. They try to present Russia as the state surrounded by the enemies. The irony is that Russian ruling elite keeps all the money in the free world. So it's quite an unusual historical paradox, promoting anti-Americanism, fighting the liberal values, but keeping all the money, not in China, not in Iran, not in Syria, but in London, in Prague, in Paris, in Berlin, and also in this country, not mentioning some of the tax havens. I think that the issue in the problem with the issues you raised in Russia is not that they are larger than in France or in Austria. You know, for instance, in Austria, you can smell a lot of anti-Semitism, even in the places where people never seen a living Jew. But it's about inability, unwillingness of the state to confront it and to mobilize public against it. And very often, the KGB interference on the side of those who they should block. Because it's an old game. It started under Yeltsin, but it was very bleak. Now it's quite an obvious framework. They always wanted to show to the rest of the world that the choice in Russia is not between Putin and democracy, but between Putin and fascists. So you don't like Putin, but look at the choice. If not for the good liberal Tsar, who is a Tsar, but he's trying to stop even these worse, terrible forces that could be totally destructive. If you look at the attacks on the foreigners, all these racial attacks and other, you will find out that very often the skinheads and these groups, they are supported or trained by the KGB that uses them as the scapegoats for crackdown on democracy.
We have time for a few more questions. Gentleman in the glasses in the white in the middle, about six rows back.
Thank you. Have you been in touch with Mikhail Gorbachev, and do you consider him an ally in your political campaign?
No. And no. Gorbachev was a big supporter of Mr. Putin because Mr. Putin, as he thinks, and he speaks out about it, realized his dream of the managed democracy. That was Gorbachev's original dream. He wanted to build socialism with a human face. My initial reaction was that Frankenstein also had a human face. Today, he is going around saying that Mr. Putin saved the country from the chaos of the 90s, and under Putin, Russia is exercising its own sovereign managed democracy. And I don't think these kind of comments could be complimentary for what we're doing.
Another question, right here.
I want to switch back to chess for a second, if I can. I have two questions. One is, after nearly 40 years of extensive training and tough competition, how does it feel to then all of a sudden step away from the game almost entirely? And the second question is, would you say that extensive training in a discipline of thinking is one of the best traits that the chess player can bring into the world outside of chess?
You can bring a lot of useful things to the outside world, not only if you're a chess player. It's providing you have something. I don't think that, as I said already, ability to play chess offers you anything more than ability to play chess, unless you know how to analyze what you're doing and you can share your own experience, not of playing chess, but your learning, how you learn certain things about making decisions and being successful or not. As for my personal feelings, I'm writing chess books. I'm following the chess competitions. And when I have to relax, I play a game of chess on the internet.
So now you know where to find him when he's not here. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Garry Kasparov.
I'm sorry, that's the...
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.